everybody, you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 292, inching ever so surely closer to that episode number 300 coming at you in just a month and a half. Crazy, crazy. If you guys want to get in touch with us, drop us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun show for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Maggie Keenan-Bulger has worked extensively with LGBT populations, including LGBT homeless youth, intergenerational groups of LGBT teens and seniors, oh, I love that, and GSAs in high schools. In 2012, her work in the LGBT community was recognized by the White House. It's right there in Washington, D.C., when she was appointed an LGBT leader of the next generation by Vice President Joe Biden. A two-time Point Foundation scholar, her pieces, Queering History and Not Just Another Coming Out Story, were written in collaboration with LGBT homeless youth and performed alongside of Broadway performers. Other credits include award-winning play From the Inside Out, which, after a successful run at the Fringe Festival in 2008, went on to complete an East Coast tour. Maggie has worked extensively as a teaching artist with organizations such as Urban Stages, the Creative Arts Team, and the Leadership Program. She's also a sex educator with the I Love Female Orgasm Program, speaking to thousands of college students across the U.S., and she is the co-founder and co-artistic director of Honest Accomplice Theater, a pretty darn inspiring company that we're going to tell you all about. The Advocate magazine just named her to a short list of the people to watch in 2015. Her latest gig is a star turn in a new piece of work cleverly titled Jury Duty. Maggie Keenan-Bulger, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you for mentioning Jury Duty. It's been an important part of the career.
I think it's huge. I think it's huge. Fringe Festival 2015 is all over this new piece that you are in called Jury Duty. How would you describe that piece, that performance piece, to everyone?
You know, lots of exciting characters, some snoring. There's plenty of snoring today. So much exciting.
To be clear, folks, Maggie Keenan-Bulger doing her civic duty, actually serving in jury duty. We all would like to know, Maggie, did he do it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Always.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. We have so much to talk about. Are you ready?
I am so ready.
Okay. Well, I want to actually start with one of the last things I said with the Advocate magazine piece, because I love the first three sentences, because it's my first question for you. They wrote, she's an actress, she's a playwright, she's a sex educator, and we don't like labels here on This Show Is So Gay, Maggie, but is there a particular label that you gravitate towards?
Oh, man. Usually I go with three.
Okay.
So I say I'm a teaching artist, sex educator, and performer.
Nice.
Which, more or less encompasses what I tend to do. So
I love it. This Advocate magazine piece, huge. How did you find out that you were going to be one of these people to watch in 2015?
I was texted by a friend at, 9 a.m. or something. I had no idea that it was happening. And so, I got a text and was like, I have no idea what they're talking about. So looked it up and there it was.
I love it. Do you wake up in the morning now and think, there are people watching me?
No, never.
Okay. Because for the rest of 2015, it's right there in the Advocate. We're watching you.
Yes, my coworker, said that I was someone to be, under high surveillance for the next little while.
I love it. I love the idea that you're walking down the streets and there are people following you, and people are like, "Why are people following you?" And you're like, "Because I'm one of the people
the
to watch."
Eyes on the street.
Yeah. 2016, it's over, but for this year, we're following Maggie.
Exactly.
Well, let's do a little Maggie Keenan-Bulger. This Is Your Life, which you're a little too young for, but let's do it anyway. Oberlin College.
Oberlin College. Yep. I loved Oberlin. I went from inner city Detroit, which is where I grew up, and where I was like the only out queer kid in my high school. I was one of 12 white kids. Like, I was as different could be. And then went to Oberlin College, where suddenly I was one of many white queer people on campus. So it was quite a change for me, and there was definitely, like, you know, the first year or so, I was like, I just don't know how to interact in this place, but, you know, everyone looks so much like I do and acts so much like I do. But eventually, I really grew to love it, and certainly the people there and the, you know, the sort of education that I was able to get was pretty amazing.
We had on last week's show, we had Elizabeth Holfer, the executive director of Equality Ohio, and you've
incredible.
You've spent time in Ohio. Can you see yourself ending up back in Ohio?
Well, I've always said that, you know, if Oberlin decided they wanted to offer me a, you know, adjunct teaching position, that, you know, I would certainly consider it.
So. I'm on it. This is my mission. I'm a college professor. I'm on it, Maggie. I will get out there.
Oh, man. I'm there.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you studied theater and gender and women's studies, and I would imagine much of that informed the work that you do.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a serendipitous. I went to Oberlin where I decided that I was not going to do theater. You know, I did sort of the conservatory auditions and things, and then eventually was like, nope, I'm going to go to Oberlin. I'm not going to do theater. I'm going to, you know, do more like political science type stuff. And of course, got to Oberlin and was like, I really miss theater. And so started doing it, couldn't stay away, but was really interested in sort of being able to combine both the like social and political activism side of things with the theater that I was doing, where I love performing and I love being on stage, but I also wanted to be able to be in shows and create shows that I felt like were giving off things and were saying things about the world that I thought sort of needed to be said. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's go there. Why use theater to educate? You know, theater, obviously, a source of entertainment for folks, but you take that entertainment and you use it as a conversation builder and to get important issues out there and discussions started. Why that medium?
Well, I think that theater is really special and it's really unique in that it is one of the very few sort of interactive art forms that we have left where you're in a room with people who are, you know, responding to what you're doing and who are, you know, there with you. And the people in the room are all sharing a common experience, you know, on both sides of the stage. And I think that because theater has always been used sort of as a tool of, you know, building empathy for characters and being able to connect to situations they might not otherwise connect with or might not otherwise be confronted with, it makes perfect sense that, you know, I think that we as activists tend to, you know, be most invested in the things that impact us or that, you know, we feel like we have a human connection with. And so I think theater is a really great way of not just, you know, using the you know, the tools of empathy and of character development and things like that to get political messages across, but to do it in a way that's exciting and enjoyable and allows the audience to be asked questions that they might not be asked otherwise.
Yeah.
And we're, like, my theater company, we're very pro not telling people what to think and more, like, questioning the status quo and, you know, sort of using satire and things like that to turn things on its head.
I love it. I love it. Well, in your bio is one of my favorite words in all of this work, and it sadly in 290 some odd episodes is not a word that comes up nearly enough when we talk about the work that you do, when we talk about the work that so many of our guests do, and that word is intergenerational. And you've done some of this intergenerational work. Talk to us about some of your experiences bringing together different generations of LGBT personalities.
I mean, I feel like I've been really, really lucky in that I've been able to incorporate so much, you know, intergenerational work in the theater that I do. I'm the main show I'm working on right now, which is called The Birds and the Bees Unabridged. We have a cast of 16 women and trans people from all around New York City, ages 20 to 70. And for so many people, the most exciting thing for them is being able to be in a room with people of such diverse age range.
Huge.
And I think in the LGBT community, it's a particularly important thing to have sort of intergenerational connections because, you know, one, I feel like there's a big stigma, particularly when you're working with both teens and seniors, that those two communities will not get along.
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of fear surrounding both of those communities where, like, you know, people don't really want to go there oftentimes. And for a lot of the young people who I work with, we, you know, I do a lot of work with LGBT homeless youth who've been kicked out of their houses. And so much of their interaction with older people is not particularly positive.
Right.
And so to not only be able to meet people who are, you know, supportive of their identity and supportive of who they are, but also people who, you know, give them a glimpse of what their future can be. And, like, you know, the number of times that, you know, people would be like, I want to be just like Rose when I grow up. Like, that's not something they were able to say before because they didn't have any people in their lives who they could look up to or who they could be like, this is a person who I admire and who I like and who, you know, gives me hope for what I can be and for who I can be.
And that's one of the things that you learn in doing intergenerational work is that all people over the age of 70 are indeed named Rose. That's something I've learned. I'm actually, I get a little choked up just thinking about it. I will say that a formative experience for me was I was so fortunate in my NYU days to be part of an intergenerational theater group in New York City called Roots and Branches. And it was...
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh, it was... I mean, it was amazing. And it was right when I was coming out. And I remember some of the things that I can't actually say on the air because they're not FCC compliant, that some of those roots said, you know, when they heard that my parents were being difficult back in the day. And it's just so formative. But as I'm sure you well know, because this is the work that you do, we just don't have enough of these opportunities to gather together different generations.
Absolutely. Well, and it's so interesting where the organization, which is called Bridging the Gap, which works specifically with LGBT populations, and we worked with FATE, which is a senior center and community for older LGBT folk, and then young people from a variety of backgrounds and locations. And the folks at SAGE talked about how oftentimes, because of the sort of, like, myths about recruiting and of, like, the older predators, LGBT predators that, you know, were sort of converting youth and things, that for so long, they were not only, you know, not interacting with young people, they were not allowed to interact with young people. And I think that, you know, thank goodness so many of those stereotypes and those sort of negative ideas about LGBT people have lessened. And so, you know, it's possible. But just the idea that, you know, not only do you not have the, you know, the ability or, you know, you don't come across younger people in your life, you know, you also are sort of forbidden from doing so. And I think one of the few things that LGBT people have that sort of specific to our minority population, different from a lot of others, is that our parents don't necessarily often aren't, you know, don't have the same minority status.
Indeed, yeah.
And parents don't share our minority identity. They can't teach us how to be a minority in the world.
Yeah.
Where I feel like, you know, there are certain things that you learn growing up as queer that, you know, would be really great to know when you were, you know, 16 or 17. And because we don't have that connection, so many of us don't have a connection with our parents, we need people to be able to be like, you know, this is what it's like, this is what it can be like, you know, this is, you know, these are things that might happen, these are things that aren't cool if they do happen, and, you know, so on and so forth, so.
Yeah, and let me push you one step further on that, because not only do we want more of these opportunities for these different generations to get together, but theater is such a uniquely positioned tool to actually create that community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great, because I think one of the best things that theater does, and particularly when I do devised theater, which is essentially creating theater without a script. So it's taken entirely from the ideas, opinions, and experiences of the people who are in the room, as opposed to, you know, some sort of overseeing playwright or something like that.
Right.
And theater is great because you're able to, you know, sort of tell your stories and tell your experiences without having to make them yours.
Right.
I've never done a device show where I have someone stand on stage and say, this is my experience, because oftentimes that can be really vulnerable and can be, you know, very hard for people. But they're able to play characters who maybe reflect a certain experience, or someone else is like, I really want to see this represented. I don't want to play that part, but I really, you know, think it's an important thing to say, or, you know, an important thing to show. And so with theater, you're able to sort of take a step back from the sort of intense personal issues. And I think seeing theater as well, where it's like, if you see a character who's going through something, you can talk about the character as opposed to having to be like, you know, when I came out, it was really traumatic and it was really hard. You know, you can be like, well, when this character came out, you know, they experienced these things that were, you know, really important. And so it's a way to sort of have a discussion without having to sort of have the focus all on the personal. And I think, you know, it's a really great sort of entry point into what can be, you know, a more vulnerable, eventually experience, but it doesn't have to be from the get-go.
Yeah.
You can sort of ease into it.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with Maggie Keenan Bulger, artist, playwright, sex educator, in what I want to say is the first of a six-part series, because I have so much to chat with you about. So much. This is, I don't get a chance to talk. I love this stuff. I love this stuff, and I don't get a chance to talk about it enough. And so I want to give you the floor for that, because I don't think that folks fully understand. Yes, you are putting entertainment up there and stimulating content, but then you're also creating this medium and engaged in a medium where people are talking afterwards, and I have no doubt that Maggie Keenan Bulger has done more talkbacks than I can shake a stick at. Talk to me about just one of those experiences when in those processing events that you do, something came up that you're like, oh my gosh, look at the forum that I put out there. I feel like you've had so many of these experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's I think more than one specific experience, it's the like, the people who come up after seeing a show or, you know, going to a workshop or something, who are like, I thought that there was something wrong with me because I felt this way, or I had this experience, or I am this person, and I thought that there was something wrong with that. And being able to see other people, you know, talking about it and having the same problems I have or having the same experiences I have made me feel normal.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the sort of idea of quote unquote normal is like a super stigmatized thing. But I think that there's something that's really important as a sex educator. When I tour around, I would say that 95% of the questions that I get, the underlying question is, am I normal?
Yeah.
So like, you know, if people come up with, you know, any sort of question, pretty much the first thing that I do is, validate it, being like, well, that's totally common, and that is, you know, not something that you need to be worried about or ashamed of, because it's something that a lot of people experience. And I think we have these sort of crazy ideas of what things are supposed to be in our world. And my theater company focuses specifically on things that we don't talk about a lot in society, because I do think there are certain, like, status quo ideas that are reinforced in, you know, the media and in our schools and government and whatnot. And so being able to open up those ideas and sort of challenge them is really important in making people feel like, you know, who they are is good and is okay and is, you know, as excellent, if not different from other people.
Listen to this mission statement, listeners. This is the Honest Accomplice Theater, of which Maggie Keenan Bulger is a co-artistic director, co-founder. Listen to this. Honest Accomplice Theater is a nonprofit with a mission to generate dialogue and stimulate change by focusing on topics that are often silenced, seen as shameful, or portrayed as one-dimensional. It does beg the question, how, and I know that I'm sure this is an ever-present question for you, how do you get past preaching to the choir? How do you get more folks into the fold, Maggie?
Well, one of the cool things that I think we've come across is that our different shows obviously, you know, focus on different communities where, you know, we have LGBT youth who we work with, and we have, you know, women and trans people who are all adults. You know, there's we work with senior centers, and we found that a lot of times what happens is, you know, people will come and see a show that's specific to their own community.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're, once they figure out that, like, okay, this is, you know, a lot of fun and really interesting and, you know, not what people often expect of political theater, where it's not, you know, bash you over the head with our agenda sort of thing. And then they'll come to other shows that they might not have come to otherwise, where, you know, maybe the seniors will come for the LGBT homeless youth show and suddenly have this whole new perspective on things. And I think that because our casts are made up of both actors and non-actors, we get a far more diverse group of people coming to see the shows, where, you know, it's all of one of our cast members' lawyer friends who come, and it's, you know, all of the disability rights activists who come, who, you know, otherwise wouldn't necessarily sit in a theater. And so And I think, you know, it's also important to say I don't think that there's anything wrong about preaching to the choir, where I feel like, especially with things like sexuality and, you know, those things that are super stigmatized.
Totally.
I think we kind of need to have it to be able to be like, yep, this is, you know, this is who we are. This is what we do or what we don't do. And, you know, that is really important that we validate that. But I think it is also, you know, super important to get folks in the seats who wouldn't be there otherwise, and, you know, who are definitely having their sort of options expanded.
Nice. Well, I do want to hit on the personal aspect, because I think when we talk about this type of work, when we talk about folks like you, Maggie Keenan-Bulger, who are getting out there and getting people talking and stimulating the conversations that people aren't having and need to have, I think we get so focused on the work, and I don't want to minimize my assumption, which I feel totally confident about, by the way, that you, Maggie Keenan-Bulger, get something out of doing this work.
Absolutely. Yes, I'm not in it for the money. That's for sure.
If folks only knew how funny that is.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like for as much as, you know, I'm able to bring sex education to people, or as much as I'm able to, you know, teach devising theater to people, I get back, you know, tenfold, you know, what I give out. And be that, you know, being able to really go in depth about trans language,
yeah,
or really be able to, you know, figure out, you know, what it's like as an older woman in our world that totally desexualizes older women, like things that I wouldn't necessarily think of in, you know, if I was to do a Maggie show about sexuality, like it would look very different from what it looks like in our cast of, you know, 16 very diverse people who come from so many different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And that's really important to me and really interesting to me as well, to be able to, you know, sort of see into other people's experiences and figure out how we can translate them in a way that other people can, you know, get from them what I feel like I get from them and what our cast and crew get from them.
Yeah, and I want to normalize that, because I think that we have any number of folks who are engaged in this work thinking, oh, you know, it's all about being selfless and I just got to give to community.
No.
That's
a recipe for burnout.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, it is very easy in our field to get burned out because we are dealing with, you know,
right,
oftentimes really hard issues, or we're dealing with, you know, very little funding for very big projects and, you know, all that good stuff. But I think it's so important for artists in particular to be able to recognize and take care of themselves, because we're we're sort of the struggling class,
yeah,
of, like, you know, people who are making things because we like to make them. And if you're not doing it because you like it and because you get something out of it, you know, there's not much incentive.
Indeed.
Do it, so.
Yeah, because folks, if you're doing Theater of the Oppressed and you're doing it for the money, you should call me, because we should talk. We should talk. That's,
yeah,
a problem.
Or I want to know where you're doing it.
Maggie went a different route on that one. I was going to talk you down. Maggie wants your job. That's great, Maggie.
Exactly.
I love it. Now, I don't know if you know this, Maggie, but so many Keenan-Bulgers out there.
Such an unusual last name, and there's so many of us.
So many. Now, I have to tell you this, and then we'll explain it to folks if they don't know. A friend of mine asked who does theater work in New York City. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine asked, oh, who's on this week's show? I said, oh, Maggie Keenan-Bulger. And he said, you know that the Keenan-Bulgers are like the Tribbles of the theater world, which was the dorkiest and funniest thing I've ever heard. So more than one Keenan-Bulger, what – I don't even know how else to say this. What other Keenan-Bulgers are out there, Maggie, that you know of?
Well, I have an older sister, Celia Keenan-Bulger, and a younger brother, Andrew Keenan-Bulger. And, yeah, they're both performers and do amazing theater work and also are really politically active. And I feel very lucky in that. I feel like we talk a lot, especially in the LGBT community, about our sort of chosen families.
Yeah.
And it just happens that my chosen family is also my, like, actual family.
I love it.
Where, you know, I the three of us really, really enjoy living in the same city and getting to hang out and getting to see what the other folks are doing, and yeah.
Now, I have to say, and I'm hoping this does not trigger any type of breakdown and that you've moved past it, so this is, not the safest setup that I've ever done on the history of the show, but when they put out there the picture for the Advocate magazine shortlist of people to watch in 2015, tell everyone what happened, Maggie.
It was actually funny. The text I got from my friend was like, congratulations on being an advocate, and sorry. And I was like, what does that mean? And I was like, oh, look, it's my sister. the headshot that they put above my name and, the bio that was pretty clearly my bio was of my sister. In sort of laughing at it, I was like, well, thank goodness it wasn't like George Bush or something.
Right.
Someone who I like, at least, could have been a lot worse.
I love it. I love that was the most Jan Brady, Kenan Bolger moment you could have had. It was great. But an artist in her own right, I feel like you have great advice for our listeners, for folks who are listening in who are thinking, gosh, I want to create some intergenerational work, or I want to get people talking. Where would you get people started on some of this?
I mean, I'm really big into collaboration,
yeah.
Where I would not be able to do, the majority of the things that I do without an incredible community of people who are also excited about it. Where I feel like I am so lucky in that there have been any number of times where I've sort of reached out and been like, hey, is anyone else interested in this? And people have jumped on board. I work primarily with a co-collaborator. His name is Rachel Sullivan, and we went to grad school together.
Nice.
I think it's such a gift to find people who you work well with and who are able to sort of complement things that you're good at and the things that you're maybe not so good at. If I didn't have the people around me, I think burnout would happen way sooner, and the work would certainly not be of the quality that it is, nor would it necessarily get done. So I feel like, surrounding yourself with people who you really enjoy and who really challenge you, but who you also, get along with is crucial.
Huge.
In this field.
And so important, again, to, gosh, we don't talk enough, Maggie, on the show about burnout. I think we just blow right by it. And it's really important that we pause and say, hey, working with other people, a really great way to address burnout.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because
awesome.
It'll happen for sure.
Without question.
And it's, it's one of those things that I feel like we don't talk about enough in our community, because, I think there's this sort of idealized notion that if we do what we love, then we'll never get tired of it, or we'll never burn out from it. But, if you don't have the right support around you, and if you don't take care of yourself, it will absolutely happen. And so, yeah, having a community of people who can sort of hold you up when things aren't going so well, and who you can hold up when things aren't going so well for them, makes such a difference.
So important. So important. Well, as we are all watching you in 2015, what do you have coming up that we're excited about?
Well, so I've been working on a show for the last couple of years called The Birds and Bees on the Bridge. As I said before, it's a show about female and trans sexuality. And we have a cast. A wonderfully diverse cast of folks ages 20 to 70.
Awesome.
And we are starting a tour. So we're starting a college tour and bringing our little show to colleges. Right now we're sort of focusing on the area that's within 3 hours of the drive.
Sure.
From New York City. But in the future, we are certainly willing and excited to expand that. And it's basically a way to get conversations started on college campuses, which I feel like is a really big and important thing right now. And it's a way of doing it that's funny and fun and, has the educational components and has the, important things that we need to know about sexuality presented in a way that's not going to alienate people and is not going to make people feel awkward, which I think is such a huge component of most of our sex education these days.
It's so important, yeah.
Yeah. So we're touring with that. And we also, my theater company also runs a group called Queer Women and Trans People in Performing Arts. And we basically, we have a Facebook page and we host events, and, you know, make sure that there's lots of networking happening, because I think that queer women and trans people are super underrepresented, particularly in more traditional forms of theater these days. And it's really important that we sort of come together and collaborate and be able to, you know, manifest more positive and more diverse representations of queer women and trans people in the performing arts. So, yeah.
Oh, I love it. Well, everyone should stroll on over to honestaccomplice.com. By the way, I will tell you, as I often do when I'm inspired and I'm like, oh God, I want to get involved. And this is so dorky of me, and I'm owning it right this very second. But I always look at board of director pages and think, well, who do I need to knock?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Always. Who do I need to knock out to be the secretary? Because that's my chosen role. And lo and behold,
my brother,
Andrew Keenan Bolger, you're going down. Yeah. The next election, I am taking down Andrew Keenan Bolger to be secretary of the board of directors of Honest Accomplice. This is what I'm shooting for.
You are more than welcome.
I bet. Yes. Well, listen, I have to tell you, I've been following everything that you've been doing. This is, in some ways, I babble more when I talk about things like this, and I get the opportunity, and I really, it's such a great opportunity for me and for our listeners to hear from someone like you who is putting themselves out there in a way that gets people talking, that's using theater to educate, that are surfacing issues that are just being silenced. I cannot begin to express to you how inspiring it is just for me to have the opportunity to hear about everything that you're doing. It's just so amazing.
Well, thank you. And I am struck that you are doing something very similar. So I appreciate that, especially coming from you.
Well, I have no doubt. I'm announcing it here, 2016, Schneck and Keenan Bolger doing a whole run of Boal in Ohio. I'm so excited.
Yes, I'm there.
Stuff.
I'm so there.
It's good stuff. Maggie Keenan Bolger, what an absolute pleasure. And please keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You can pull all the stops out till they call the cops out. Grind your behind till you're banned.
Folks, and we are back. Well, a couple different programming notes before we get to the news, because the show So Gay can now be found on a number of new stations, and we wanted to give them a nice little shout out. First, we can now be found on Stitcher Stitcher.com, and Stitcher.com has all the greatest podcasts out there. So if you're looking for This Show Is So Gay, if you're looking for other LGBT podcasts, if you're looking for any podcast to carry you through your drive or your workout or just your free time or maybe even while you're working, Stitcher.com, a lot of great stuff going on over there. And This Show Is So Gay can also be found on RainbowRadio.fm, which is a new station that's out there. It's a 24/7 news, entertainment, and talk radio station geared towards the LGBT community. They just went live, I mean, like 3 or 4 days ago. So huge congratulations to them. Love, love, love whenever there are new mediums out there for LGBT content. So our buddies over on Cocktails and Cream Puffs, they can be found over there on RainbowRadio.fm. A number of great, great shows, and you can stroll on over there, RainbowRadio.fm. And finally, it's podcast awards season out there. So last year we were nominated as one of the top 10 best LGBT podcasts for the Podcast Awards, the National Podcast Awards, and they are taking nominations right now. So we would love it if you strolled on over to podcastawards.com. It takes approximately 6 seconds. No joke. It takes approximately 6 seconds to just go on there, go to the category of Best GLBT Podcast, and you can type in This Show Is So Gay and put our homepage, which is thisshowissogay.com, which you know that already, but thisshowissogay.com. On the bottom left, you just type in your name and your email address. Literally, it's 4 fields. It's like, you know, 100 characters for you to type, if that. You click submit, and you've now nominated This Show Is So Gay for Best GLBT Podcast over at podcastawards.com. If you can't tell already, my voice is fading a little bit, but I'm going to try to make it because I refuse to believe that I'm getting the flu for the second time this year. So, and I had the flu shot, so I don't get it. I don't get it. It's not fair. So we will turn to some national news. We got some local news. We got a lot of news, a lot of news out there. Let's start with the State of the Union. Did you guys check out the State of the Union? There were 6,718 words in the State of the Union. Not as many people heard them as have heard them in the past. I just read that the ratings were a little bit down. But if you did hear it, or if you read the news afterwards, you heard that there was a big watershed moment because one of those 6,718 words was a new word to United States State of the Union's, never been said before, and that word is transgender. President Obama became the first president to say the word transgender during a high-profile occasion, and most advocates for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights are thrilled. There were some great quotes about this. It's actually a Time magazine article about it that you should absolutely check out. There was this quote from author and MSNBC host Janet Mock. She told Time magazine, quote, "The president's acknowledgement helped shatter the cloak of invisibility that has plagued trans people and forced many to suffer in silence. By speaking our community's name, the president pushes us all to recognize the existence and validity of trans people as Americans worthy of protection and our nation's resources," end quote. Just a lot of praise for the president. There were certainly some kind of post-gay articles, deconstructionist gay articles out there, op-ed saying, okay, he said a word. Is it really that big of a deal? He didn't lay out a plan. But it is a big deal. It is a big deal when that acknowledgement has never been provided before and President Obama is providing it for the first time. So yay for President Obama, and let's now see if there's legislation that is endemic to saying that word. It would be amazing. It would be amazing. There was also this quote. I love this quote from Shannon Minter, the legal director for the National Center for Lesbian Rights. He said, quote, "As a transgender man and an advocate for transgender people, it was thrilling to hear for the first time in our nation's history the President of the United States acknowledge transgender people as an integral and valued part of our national community." There you go. It's right there. It's right there. The president also did have a shout-out to marriage equality and certainly established it as a civil right, which, you know, it is. And we're looking at Florida right now and the court decisions that now allow marriage equality in Florida. Unsurprisingly, it is a boon to the economy, a huge, huge boon to the economy. When same-sex couples started saying, "I do," across Florida the first week of January, travel agents and wedding planners started fielding calls from gay and lesbian couples within the Sunshine State and far beyond. With Florida already a popular choice for destination weddings, the state's thriving tourism industry, and an LGBT scene in Miami and South Beach that draws vacationers from around the country, Florida stands to benefit from same-sex wedding boom now over the next 3 years and well into the future. just to give you guys a sense, the wedding business is huge in the U.S. It generates about $51 billion per year. But in Florida alone, in 2015, in Florida alone, same-sex wedding couples already living in Florida, it is estimated that they are going to add $116 million to the state's economy, according to the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. That projection is based on estimated wedding-related costs like venue rentals and guest expenses such as hotel rooms and meals. $116 million just in 2015, just in Florida. So for all the crass people out there who are like, I don't really care about rights. I don't care about individual rights. I just care about the economy. Well, marriage equality, yeah, that's going to help the economy. It's going to help it a lot, quite a bit. Miami-based LGBT travel expert Vicky Garcia, the chief operating officer of Cruise Planners American Express Travel, says pent-up demand will drive the numbers. She said this, quote, "Those who are marrying now are making a statement. We've definitely seen a bump in phone calls in the past week." So exciting. Further, it's just going to keep going. The average length of an engagement these days is about 14 months, which means many same-sex couples are planning now for Florida weddings in 2016 and 2017. The Williams Institute estimates a total of $182.2 million spent through 2017 on about 24,000 same-sex weddings of in-state couples alone. So exciting. But not all is good news there in the Florida. For those couples who want to get married right away, having been together for 4 years, Melissa McCord and her partner did not waste time taking advantage of Florida's marriage equality, marrying on January 10th, right away. Still, the Jacksonville mothers of two wanted to plan a nice formal ceremony to share with family and friends and sought out a wedding planner. Lana Rusev of Simply Elegant Wedding Planning wrote back to them that she was already booked for the weekend they wanted, but bothered to add, she wanted to add this, quote, "Due to my strong personal belief, I do not feel comfortable planning a wedding for lesbian couples. I hope you understand," and then my favorite part, "and not take this personally." Unsurprisingly, Melissa McCord did take it personally. She told the First Coast News, quote, "Just send me an email and let me know you were overbooked. Don't throw your belief in my face that you won't do it because of what we are. My money is just as green as everybody else's." Well, this became a big story down in Jacksonville, and now Rusev, the proprietor of Simply Elegant Wedding Planning, which not so simply elegant when it comes to rights, she is standing by her discrimination. She said this, quote, "I understand that they may be hurt, but there are other wedding planners who are okay with doing this. Take your business elsewhere. If I hurt anyone, I apologize, but this is my personal belief. We are all entitled to our beliefs. Just to let you know, because I don't want you guys to be worried that they couldn't find another wedding planner, McCord and her partner did indeed find another wedding planner, so don't worry about it. But she's also adding Rusev's business to a list on Facebook that tracks businesses that are not friendly to the LGBT community. Rusev, again, the proprietor of Simply Elegant Wedding Planning, she is not happy with the backlash that she's facing. On Facebook, she suggested that the First Coast News cut out some of her remarks, claiming, "I have absolutely nothing against these individuals, but I am not afraid to stand for what I believe. I will continue to stand my ground and not be bullied. Our Facebook has been swarmed by discriminating comments and negative reviews." Yeah, I could see that happening. You said, "Hey, I wouldn't do this for you anyway, even if I wasn't already booked." There was no reason to go there. Well, Rusev does have a champion in her cause, and it is, of course, our buddies over at the Family Research Council. Oh, gosh, how they keep busy is beyond me, but there they are. The Family Research Council, they came to her defense. They cited her as another victim of LGBT equality. I love that there are victims of LGBT equality. I love that there are victims of equality. Same marriage, quote, "sure impacts their family when they're fined, forced out of business, or lose their home simply for following their moral conscience." That's what the Family Research Council put out there in their press statement. And yes, there are victims of marriage equality. Just to let you know, on the legislative front, Jacksonville does not have any protections. The city council rejected them in 2012 by a vote of 17-2. This means that McCord and her family have no legal case to make against Rusev. So they're going a different route and just going with social media. So that's on the one side of you have these wedding businesses, cake makers, florists, wedding planners who are saying, no, it's against my moral beliefs. By the way, I'm already booked, but just wanted to give you a heads up. It's against my beliefs. No reason. There was no reason. What does that serve? What does that serve? Except to say, I would think you would put that out there. Hey, tell your gay friends they probably shouldn't come to me either. So I feel like that's all this couple is really doing is putting it out there. Hey, she doesn't want our business. They can't sue her. That municipality in Jacksonville, they don't have protections for sexual orientation. So they can't sue this wedding planner. So they're just taking her up on her implicit offer to say, look, this wedding planner does not want to work with our community. And that's all they're doing is putting that out there. So you started the ball rolling, my friend. If you are a victim of equality, I guess this is why. I don't know. Now, on the total opposite side of the spectrum, this is slightly hilarious. After a Denver bakery refused to make a Colorado resident's cake with an anti-gay message, the guy then filed a discrimination complaint with the State Department of Regulatory Agency's Civil Rights Division. Marjorie Silva, the owner of Asukar Bakery, said that Bill Jack, this Colorado resident, asked her to write phrases like "God hates gays" on a cake in March 2014. He also wanted an image of two men holding hands with an X through them on the cake, because that's dessert-like, apparently. Silva told KUSA this quote, "After I read it, I was like, no way, we're not doing this. This is just very discriminatory and hateful." She told Fox 31 Denver that she did offer to make Jack a cake with a blank Bible on which he could write in the phrases himself. Look at that. Compromise. Silva said that this Colorado resident refused that option and told her to consult with an attorney. He then filed a discrimination complaint against the bakery, and Silva then received a notice that the Department of Regulatory Affairs was investigating the complaint. In a statement, he said that the bakery discriminated against him due to his religious beliefs. This is what he said, quote, "I believe I was discriminated against by the bakery based on my creed. As a result, I filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Division. Out of respect for the process, I will wait for the director to release his findings before making further comments." He is the founder of Worldview Academy, a camp that, quote, "trains Christians to think and live in accord with a biblical worldview." There you go. Republican state lawmaker Gordon Klingenschmitt, the anti-gay former Navy chaplain who once tried to perform an exorcism on President Obama, he has now gotten involved in the case. He told Fox 31 Denver that he supports, actually, the baker's right to not print the Bible on her cakes. Klingenschmitt is working on a bill to repair the state's non-discrimination statute. There you go. He said this, quote, "These laws have no religious or free speech exemptions, so right now there's a loophole that's allowing these bakers to be brought up on charges of discrimination. I think the loophole ought to be fixed so that every baker, every artist, every person in Colorado is not compelled by the government to produce anything they personally disagree with." Which, by the way, my friends, that's going to be two-edged, because he is also obviously arguing for people to refuse services to LGBT people. So, yeah. I don't know about that one. So thank you, Republican state lawmaker Gordon Klingenschmitt. We see where you're going with this, sir. Now, this is different than the Florida story, because at least this baker said, we'll totally make you a cake. Here's even a piping thingy. I learned that from Becca because she's a baker. You can write your own message on there. We will provide you with the services. We're just not going to do the final inscription on the cake. So they tried, but they didn't want to put that on the cake. It was kind of offensive. And it's not dessert-like, people. That's not dessert-like. Still with some wedding stories, former NSYNC member and Mississippi native Lance Bass and his husband, Michael Turchin, will make history next month when E!, the E! Network, televises their wedding special, the first broadcast ceremony between two men. So exciting. The network contacted the couple the night that Lance proposed to Michael in New Orleans in September 2013 with the idea for the event. Bath said this quote, "We immediately said, hell no, there is no way we would do this, but we came around really quickly. After we thought about it for a few hours, we knew this could be something really big and special for the LGBTQ community around the world." Bass, whose family is from Laurel and Ellisville, grew up in Clinton, Mississippi, before going on to sell more than 50 million albums as a member of NSYNC. Weeks before his December 20th marriage to Turchin, a judge in Mississippi ruled the state's ban on same-sex marriage unconstitutional. Bass went on to say this quote, "It makes me so happy to see how far Mississippi has come. We've worked so hard the last few years to be visible and to try to turn the temperature down in the South to more positive and accepting of the gay community. It went a lot quicker than I ever imagined it could have gone. My whole thing was, I just don't want my beloved state to be last. We're last in so many other things. I'm so glad that we were one of the first states in the South to really make this happen." So exciting. So you guys can all tune in. I'm totally going to watch it. So E! Will be televising that wedding, and that is coming up. Still in the Hollywood vein of our stories for this week, Kevin Hart, huge movie star. Huge movie star. He has played a businessman. He has played a security guard and even a boxing promoter. But one role you might never see him take on is a gay character. In a recent interview with The Breakfast Club on Power 105.1, Kevin Hart said he just wasn't comfortable portraying a homosexual character on the screen. He said this quote, "No, not because I have any ill will or disrespect. It's because I don't think I'm really going to dive into that role 100% because of insecurity about myself trying to play that part. Does that make sense? Like, what I think people are going to think while I'm trying to do this is going to stop me from playing that part the way I'm supposed to." End quote. I don't know about that one. He's really trying in this quote to say no disrespect, but so too did the wedding planner in Jacksonville say it's nothing personal. Kind of feels a little bit personal. The actor told this New York hip-hop radio station that he had turned down a gig as a gay character in the 2008 comedy Tropic Thunder. He said that he declined this role, which was later given to Brandon T. Jackson, because the character was too, quote, flagrant, although in the final script of the movie, the character's sexuality was much less obvious, with him only admitting he was gay at the end of the film. Kevin Hart went on to say this quote, "In my defense, first of all, before I say this, I'm politically correct. To the gay community, I respect and appreciate you for everything y'all do," he said y'all, not me, "and as people, I love you. The part was way more in the beginning. The dude was doing a lot of stuff in the draft that I read. I'm not saying it was real flagrant. It was a lot of stuff, and I was like, I can't do this." He said that he hasn't completely ruled out the possibility of taking such a role on in the future. He said, quote, "Right now, it's just not on the drawing board." I don't know. I like Kevin Hart. I think he's very, very funny. But this doesn't feel right at all. This doesn't feel right at all. It's hard when an actor says, "I can play anything." Oh, wait a second, but I can't play gay. I cannot play gay. By the way, there is the whole Billy Crystal story that I don't feel like I can appropriately sum up for you all. Billy Crystal had a number of quotes this week, and really disappointing because they were quite anti-gay. They were anti-gay about he feels that there's too much gay sex on TV, and then he tried to clarify, and Billy Crystal was one of the first actors to play a gay role on TV in the legendary comedy Soap. And I'm not going to cover the story. I encourage you all to go on HuffPost Gay Voices, because Noah, the editor-in-chief there of the Gay Voices section, who we've had on the show a number of times, does such a better job summarizing it for you all. He's got a great piece on there about why Billy Crystal's response is really problematic. So stroll on over to the Huffington Post, and it's sitting right there for you guys to read. A quick shout-out to Dear Abby. We love Dear Abby. Dear Abby had some great advice for a grandmother who referred to herself as, quote, heartbroken. She told Dear Abby in a letter that she came out of the closet when her son was 4. After he, now 30, and his wife had their second child, the family cut this grandmother out of their lives completely. Dear Abby had some great advice for this grandmother, including ways in which she could redirect her maternal instincts if her son refused to be part of her life. She wrote this quote back to this grandmother, quote, if your son is under the mistaken impression that he is going to somehow protect his children by isolating them from gay people, he must be living in an alternate reality. Does he also plan to emigrate to the moon? I suspect you have put your finger squarely on the reason why your son is now ostracizing you. His wife appears to wield the power in that family and could benefit by learning more about homosexuality and her religion, which I assume preaches love and tolerance for one's fellow man rather than judgment and exclusion. Dear Abby goes on to tell the grandmother that she should, quote, leave open the possibility that they may, over time, reconcile their love for you with their faith, and then she suggests becoming a mentor for LGBT youth who have been kicked out of their homes by anti-queer parents and gives her contact info for PFLAG. Other advice columnists similar to Dear Abby have a history of being allies to the LGBT community. It's been so great. They've offered, so many of these columnists have offered pro-queer words of wisdom to readers seeking advice. My favorite is Amy Dickinson, who's often on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which I used to listen to all the time. And for some reason, I've fallen off the bandwagon of listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Nothing to do with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I just have come up with other things to do. But Amy Dickinson two years ago, actually told a concerned parent who was trying to change her son's sexuality. She said, quote, if you cannot learn to accept him as he is, it might be safest for him to live elsewhere. It was amazing. Dear Abby last year shut down a homophobic couple who were excluding their new gay neighbors from social events. Abby told the couple that perhaps they chose the wrong place to live, but also that, quote, if you interact only with people like yourselves, you will have missed a chance for growth, which is what you have been offered here. Please don't blow it. I love when advice columnists get involved. Very exciting. Very exciting. And you know what, folks? That about wraps things up for this week's episode. Again, stroll on over to rainbowradio.fm, and you can hear our show on there now and on stitcher.com, and go to podcastawards.com to the GLBT category, and you can nominate This Show Is So Gay for the best GLBT podcast of the year. It takes about 2 seconds to do. You guys get out there, use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
May I suggest to you, may I suggest this is the best part of your life? May I suggest this time is blessed for you, this time is blessed and shining almost blinding bright. Just turn your head and you'll begin to see the thousand reasons that were just beyond your sight. The reasons why I'd suggest to you, why I'd suggest this is the best part of your life. Addressed to you, intended only for your eyes. It's a sacred word, like a treasure chest to you, of private scenes and brilliant dreams that mesmerize. A tender lover's smile, a tiny baby's hands, the million stars that fill the turning sky at night. And I